thank Danny for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. So indeed, originally I planned to talk about entropy of rotating and distorted black holes, but then just well, less than 24 hours ago, Lee insisted that I do a talk about something completely different, which is what I'll attempt to do now. So the talk will be in particular about a semi-classicality criterion for states of quantum geometry. And basically what the criterion is going to say is that if somebody gives me a candidate family of semi-classical states, then that family should have knowledge about the Newton potential. And so the criterion will tell you how to tease the Newton potential out of such a proposed family. So here's the plan. So I'll start with an introduction and I'll give you an overview of what I plan to do. Then I'll talk about how people extract the static potential from continuum quantum field theory. This will provide us with the motivation for the criterion. So then I introduce the criterion. And as a test, I'm going to look at the polymer picture of linearized quantum gravity, and we'll see that we can retrieve the Newton potential from that, and then I'll end with the summary. So what is the issue really? Most of the candidates in classical states that have been proposed so far are kinematical states. Now, of course, what we would like eventually is states that are physical, that is, they should solve the constraints, and that means they will then presumably be heat around diffeomorphism classes of metrics, as opposed to the kinematical states, which are heat at particular metrics. And the viewpoint I'm going to take is that there should be a sense in which the kinematical semi-classical states people have proposed could be gauged fixed versions of the physical states. So the picture is, so here's phase space, and here's the constraint surface. The constraints generate gauge orbits, and physical semi-classical states would be peaked around a gauge orbit, while gauge fixed states would be in kinematical state space, would be peaked around a particular configuration, or rather a particular point of phase space. However, gauge-fixed states should still know about the constraints. In particular, a viable family of kinematical semi-classical states should know about the Newtonian potential. That will be the main thing in this talk. Now, in ordinary continuum quantum field theory, the static potential occurs when the theory is in the Coulomb phase, which means that both the Wilson and the Trove loops decay exponentially with the perimeter of the loop. But also, the subleading term in the exponent of the Wilson loop should yield the static potential. And the Wilson loop, as an order parameter, can be, so one thing I'll do is reformulate the Wilson loop in terms of the overlap of appropriately chosen further states. This will get us to this semi-classicality criterion I want to propose. And then, as I said, as a test, I'm going to use this criterion in the polymer picture of linearized quantum gravity. As you'll see, we indeed get the Newton potential. So first, how does one get the static potential from continuum quantum field theory? So first of all, in what kind of physical setup do we expect the physics to be governed by the static potential? Well, consider, for instance, a two-particle state in quantum electrodynamics. So we have two fermions, and then some state for the electromagnetic field. We let the state evolve for a long time, long compared to the distance between the particles. The states for each particle are Gaussian beat with some spread delta x. And so when do we expect Newtonian type or Coulombic type behavior well, certainly, so as I said, we want the particles to interact for a long time, but this interaction time should be much smaller than the classical collision time. By that, I just mean the time it takes for two particles to collide, starting from rest, assuming they interact only through Coulomb force, and also the distance between the particles should, of course, be much larger than the spread of the wave function, and this spread should in turn be much larger than the Compton wavelength, which is essentially saying that the kinetic energy of each particle should be small compared to the rest mass. So we basically want these two particles to be sitting there during the entire interaction. And so incidentally, in quantum electrodynamics, the classical collision time is proportional to the square root of mass. So these, all of these inequalities can easily be satisfied if you make our fermion sufficiently massive. And that's when we expect the physics to be dominated by static potential. And of course, eventually, we want to talk about gravity. And at first, it seems like there's going to be a problem here. Because if you increase the mass, you also increase the force between the particles, of course, because mass acts like charge in gravity. And indeed, the classical collision time is inversely proportional to the square root of mass here. So can we still satisfy these inequalities, which we believe leads to Coulombic behavior? And you can almost read off that we can indeed have interaction time much smaller than the classical collision time if we set the distance between particles to be much larger than the classical Schwarzschild radius. And that's, of course, something that fits in perfectly with what we want to do. So that's fine. But I want to continue with QED for just a while longer. So with the assumptions on the previous sheet, one can show that in that approximation, the transition amplitude for the process I described factorizes into one factor that only has to do with photons, it only has to do with the electromagnetic field, and another factor that only has to do with the fermions. And this factor that only knows about the electromagnetic field is the Wilson loop. So the Wilson loop is a fog vacuum excitation value of this operator here, where A hat is the vector potential operator, and F is the smearing factor for a rectangular loop, where these edges are in the time-like direction, and these are spatial. And so the form factor gives us a three-dimensional Gaussian smearing around this loop. Now, for our purposes, it will be better to work with spatial loops, and you can think of those as sort of a Wick-rotated version of the time-like ones. So now, I mean, the only difference is that now these long edges are just in the space-like direction, and we still want the cross edges to be much smaller than that length. And we can again write down a Wilson loop. Now only spatial indices will come in, and here this F is now a completely spatial form factor again for this rectangular loop that has some smearing with epsilon, small string. And if we do this calculation, then we find that indeed the Wilson loop decays exponentially with the perimeter of the loop, which is a necessary condition to be in the Coulomb phase of the theory. And the interesting bit for our purposes will be that the subleading term gives you the Coulomb potential. Now, this may seem surprising because, as I said, the Wilson loop is just, you know, we just define it in quantum Maxwell theory. It doesn't know anything about fermions. So how does the Wilson loop know about the static potential? Well, if you consider the way in which the Wilson loop appeared in this process where you have a scattering of two fermions or interaction of two fermions, what the Wilson loop really does there is encode the bit about interchange of virtual photons. So even though no fermions are involved, but we do have this virtual photon exchange. And in fact, if you do the calculation, the way the Coulomb potential comes about is through this quote-unquote time integral of a component of the Euclidean propagator. Now, the Wilson loop can be reformulated in terms of appropriately chosen coherent states. What we're going to do is consider the same spatial rectangle and break it up into two pieces. And then we're going to associate the state with each of the pieces. So on the left, we're going to pick a coherent state, each at a particular phase space point, which has zero vector potential and electric field that's proportional with a smearing factor for this half of the loop. And then the same on the other side. And then it's not hard to see that the inner product of these two coherent states is exactly the Wilson loop. And so this thing also will decay exponentially with the circumference of the loop, and it will also be associated with the static potential. And then an expression that will be useful later for purely technical reasons is the overlap of these states involves an exponential of this particular momentum space integral involving a product of the form factors for the entire loop divided by k. And this is just how it's just something you might want to remember. We can now play the same game in linearized quantum gravity. We don't really have the Wilson loop there, but of course, there's no problem in defining similar coherent states. So this time, so again, we have the same rectangle. And we define two coherent states. One is peaked at a point in phase space where the metric perturbation is zero, and its conjugate is proportional to a form factor, which is now a symmetric Q tensor. And then the same for the other half. And we find a very similar behavior. So if we calculate the inner product, we find an expression that's very similar to the one for electromagnetism. And again, we have this Coulombic behavior, and the static potential in this case is going to be the new potential, of course. And this is, we need to say something else first. In the case of linearized quantum gravity, there's actually an important difference with electromagnetism. In quantum Maxwell theory, this form factor that came into the Wilson loop only had was just a vector field, and a Gaussian form factor for a closed loop is automatically transversed. So in the Wilson loop, the transversality of this form factor is going to force transversality on the vector potential operator. So in electromagnetism, to get the desired result, it doesn't matter whether or not you impose the constraints. But this two tensor form factor that comes into the gravity calculation is not traceless. So here it doesn't make a difference whether or not the constraints are imposed on the metric perturbation operator. And a surprising fact is that to get the Newtonian potential in this exponential, one should not impose the constraints. And this will seem very weird. This is very odd. But, when I first realized this, I was very surprised. But it is consistent with the way the Wilson loop in electromagnetism emerges from this quantum electrodynamics calculation I described. So remember the Wilson loop as the part that encodes the exchange of photons. Now, these virtual bosons are, of course, not on shell, and that is why one should not impose constraints in this calculation to get the result you want. And precisely the fact that we can work at the kinematical level is what is going to lead us to a criterion on states in the kinematical state space of loop quantum gravity. So here's our criterion. Suppose F is some family of candidate semi-classical states in the kinematical state space of loop quantum gravity, then the minimum I would expect is that the family is rich enough such that it contains states similar to the ones we were considering earlier, similar to these coherent states. So we should be able to pick out two states such that each is peaked at a phase space point where the connection is proportional to a form factor for half of a rectangular loop, and the triad is flat. And then if we calculate the overlap of these two states, then the criterion is that we should recover the Coulomb phase behavior. So we should have exponential decay with this length, and we should be able to retrieve the new differential. So that's the criterion. And now, of course, the motivation of the criterion comes from pure continuum quantum field theory. And the state space of quantum geometry is very different from that. There we have this polymer picture. And one might say, well, you know, there's all kinds of things that could go wrong. So now I want to test the criterion in a setting that is similar to that of the full theory, and where we have a lot of control. And that's the polymer picture for linearized quantum gravity. And the structures we have there are really quite similar to the ones we have in full theory. So first of all, the quantum configuration space will consist of generalized U1 cubed connections. And these take piecewise analytic edges and send them to a group element, U1 cubed in this case, not SU2. Then next, we can consider cylindrical functions of this configuration space, which will be spanned by flux network states. Flux network states are the equivalents of spin network states. And so just like spin network states, they're based on a graph. Each edge of the graph carries an order triplet of integers, which corresponds to a U1 cube representation. And so the state is then defined in this way. So we write U1, these generalized U1 cube connections as a triplet of U1 connections. And then for each separately, we evaluate it at an edge, and then raise this to the power n i 1, and so forth, same for the other factors. And then we take a product of all of this, and that will give us a spin network state. And then the imposition of the Gauss constraint would amount to saying that for, say, the first elements in each triplet, at a vertex, the sum of the incoming integers should be zero, with a plus or minus sign depending on the orientation of the edge. In ket notation, we'll denote states like this in this way. So beta is the graph, and n underscore is the set of labelings of the edges. We have an inner product. A natural inner product defined by the power measure of U1 cubed, which again is similar to what we do in the full theory. And so this inner product can then be used to complete the Hilbert space, which would be the kinematical state space of linearized quantum gravity. Now, as in the continuum theory, to get the result we want, no constraints need to be imposed. To sharpen the calculations, or to sharpen the point, I'm not even going to impose the Gauss constraint. So these ordered triplets of integers on the edges can be arbitrary. So my service is.
How could you, if this is 11, right, how could you hope to get Coulomb law around free charges
Free charges?
So places with Gauss's law are dissatisfied with their charges. This is electromagnetism.
Oh, okay, that's great.
And you wouldn't expect to see the Coulomb law between two separate charges. If in between them there could be any distribution of other charges.
Yeah, but remember the motivation from the continuum theory. So basically the way the potential came about there was it comes from a propagator associated with the virtual particle, so which is off shell, and that is really the root of this, you know, the reason why we don't have the inverse constraints. It's a bit of a subtle issue, but it works.
I mean, wouldn't it be just easier to just say you impose the constraints and you impose and then
you have... Yeah, you can impose the constraints, in fact, and you'll still get the mutant potential in this experiment and so forth, but it'll have this funny green factor. You can still do that. There's no problem with it. But to sharpen the point I want to make, I'm not going to impose the constraints, and as we'll see, we'll still get the new potential out of the theory. Now, to get to semi-classical states, we're going to follow the procedure given to us by Varadarajan, who showed that Fock-based states have natural images in Sill's star. Sill's star is the algebraic dual of Sill. Basically, what he did was he rewrote what he called the Poincaré invariance condition, which is just the condition that the Fock factor should be annihilated by all of the annihilation operators. And he rewrote this in terms of triad perturbations and smeared velocities. And here's the explicit expression. It's very messy, but nevertheless, it does encode this very simple condition. So here's our smeared holonomy. It's not a holonomy for an edges. It's not. It's a holonomy for fluxes at work. And we don't just have one condition. We have infinitely many, just like here. What we do is we consider all possible graphs and all possible locations. And then the Fock vacuum will solve this equation. And then what Varadarajan did was to take this equation and replace the triad perturbations by smeared triad perturbations and replace the smeared holonomies by unsmeared ones. And this allows you to apply this operator condition on states in Sill's star. So this is what we're going to impose. And that's how he obtained an image of the Fock. And here's what the solution looks like. Fortunately, it looks far simpler than the equation that determines it. So it's, of course, a superposition of duals of flux networks. So we have a sum over graphs and a sum over labelings, where the coefficients are given by this matrix Gij. And here's what it looks like. So the Fi and Fj are form factors for the edges I and j. And we have this momentum integral times k. And that gives us this matrix. So that's what the vacuum looks like. But by a very similar procedure, we can locate any coherent state in Sill's star, or indeed any Fock space state. And for instance, if we consider a coherent state that is peaked at a phase-space point where the connection is proportional to some form factor we pick, and the triad perturbation is zero, then this is what we get. So FAB here, that's basically this classical connection. And the F with the tildes are form factors for edges. Now, an important step will be to take shadow states, so-called shadow states of these states in SIL star. What does that mean? Well, consider a state in SIL star. It's a linear combination of duals of flux network states. And this involves, again, a sum over graphs and a sum over labelings of graphs. Now, suppose we focus on one particular graph, which means one particular term in this sum here, and take the dual of it. This will give us a shadow on that graph. And if you vary the graphs, so if you consider all possible shadow states, you don't get a cylindrical function. But nevertheless, all of the shadow states together do capture the full information present in this SIL star element. And so again, we can do this for any Fox state. And then in the remainder of the talk, I'm going to specialize to shadow states on regular cubic lattices. This is simply something I want to do to make my life easy, facilitate calculations. And so I'll pick a lattice with some lattice size n. That would be the linear size in one of the three directions, number of edges, let's say, and edge length of little l. And then we can consider shadows of these particular coherent states we had earlier in the continuum theory. So first what we do is we take these coherent states, we take their image in SIL star, and then we consider the shadow states on our cubic lattice. And so again, we have a state, so we have this rectangle, and another feature that facilitates calculations, although I'm sure it's not essential, is that I assume that the rectangle is made out of edges of the lattice. It's a subset of the lattice. And so one state will relate to one half of the rectangle, and then another state for the other half. And then one can show that, I mean, it's quite a calculation, but at the end of the day, if you take an overlap of two such coherent states, then indeed, approximately, you are going to recover the Fox state result. And in particular, so we'll do things in two steps. First, we're going to take the limit where the size of the lattice goes to infinity, then the limit where the edge length goes to zero. So if we take the size of the lattice to infinity, what we get is an expression that's already very similar to the Fox space expression, except that this momentum integral is now limited to a cube in momentum space with linear size inversely proportional to the edge length. And physically, that's very reasonable. That just means that the lattice, the finite edge length can be viewed as an ultraviolet cutoff. And then next we take the limit for edge length going to zero, and lo and behold, we recover the exact Fox case result. And this in particular means that we have recovered the Newton potential, because if you go to the next step and calculate this out, then what you find is Coulombic behavior again. So this object decays exponentially with the perimeter of the loop, and the sublinear term gives us the Newton potential. So the shadow states do have information about the lattice. Information comes in from, let me show you. So So this is what a typical, this is, well, this is of course a Gwydion statement sort of started. If you just flip this around, you get shadow. And so this GIJ matrix is present. So that knows about the edge length. And what else? Yeah, that's it basically. So information about the edge length comes from the vacuum, the fog vacuum part. If you express it in momentum space, does it have to go? Yeah, it does. Yeah. I mean, remember GIJ is just so GIJ is proportional to d3k times k times product of form factors for the edges, and these form factors know about it. I'm not sure whether I'm answering your question.
But the form factors equals to know about edge length. But why did you have, why is the momentum equals only cut off at 5 over L?
How did that come about? Okay, let me, it's been a while, so let me look up this calculation again. Actually, can we discuss this later on? Because, I mean, it's quite an involved calculation, and I can show it to you, but let's discuss that.
But
is it,
does it come out of the calculation, or is it something
that has involved? No, it's not added, it comes out of the calculation.
Can I ask the most naive question possible? It's very complicated. But you started off with saying you're not imposing any constraints.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how do we solve identical equations?
Yeah.
How do quantum states have this constant in them? Where do they get the mass of these fermions that are supposed to be the source?
Oh, those come from the masses come from the form factors. I just need a dimension there. It's something dimensional for me to put
but
in.
But the kind of solving dynamical equations, how do you know that those aren't the mass of any particles, depending on the g, which comes out, is actually constant.
You don't know, and the reason is the same as when you calculate the just the Wilson loop in continuum quantum Maxwell theory, that theory doesn't know about fermions, and I mean, the charge doesn't come in.
I don't think so.
Except of course, as the dimension for parameters, you just put in by hand. So the answer is just like in the calculation of the Wilson loop. These parameters are put in just by hand, and the way it happens is through the
process.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you ask about you write down the definition of the kinematic annihilation operator. That annihilation operator already has inside the propagator. So it's not a surprise that we get it.
So in some sense, you have to equate the solution to the function.
In some sense,
in the integration operates the process.
So you can write a formula for both an expert theory or maybe an expert theory has something like a kinematic annihilation operator with a projection operator in between. In expert theories, if you project sound onto the transverse folds, and in linear expert theory, it's just a transverse operator symmetric. So
if you forget all that operation, you still have annihilation operators, and this is what where it's coming from. So the annihilation operators in metrics are already capable of known potential filtering.
Actually,
I'm not sure I agree with you. So you're saying there's some kind of projection to transverse
spaces?
In the Hamiltonian. In the Hamiltonian, okay.
Well, sure, it's in the Hamiltonian.
The Hamiltonian is a
transverse. Oh, okay, so, but. Are the states here solid?
I don't know whether the Hummingbird doesn't come in, but we use it in order to define the Fock states. Fock states are too small.
Yeah, that's right. So you're saying that this complicated expression that That gives you the fuck. Yeah. That I agree.
So, I think the answer is that certainly in the usual continuum theory, you do produce a propagated photon, and therefore the quantum theory does know about the rate of motion of electric matter.
Yeah, that's how it's how it comes in. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so the result of this calculation, as I said, is that we do indeed find the Newton potential as expected. And so at least in linearized quantum gravity, our criterion goes through. I'm just going to finish early, I guess. But so here's a summary. What we've done is we started from a continuum quantum field theory calculation. In particular, we looked at the Wilson loop as an order parameter. And to get to a semi-classicality criterion for states of quantum geometry, we simply reformulated it in terms of these coherent states. Our criterion basically says that if I have a family of semi-classical states, then they should know about the Newton potential to be viable, even at the kinematical level already. Then we checked the criterion in a theory where, or a framework where we have very good control over what goes on, namely the Fowler picture of linearized quantum gravity. And we find that the criterion works very well there. And also want to view this calculation as proof that you can get the Newton potential from Palmer linearized quantum gravity. And what the next thing I would like to do is now to use this criterion in the full theory and check whether any of the states already proposed by various people satisfy the criterion. And so that's an interesting question. But also interesting is, might there be a fuller sense in which the semi-classical sector of loop quantum gravity is like the Coulomb phase? Because remember that the Wilson loop, the exponential decay with perimeter of the Wilson loop is only a necessary condition to be in the Coulomb phase. You should also check the behavior of the Torf loop. And so basically, the Torf loop can be viewed as a jewel of the Wilson loop. And to be in the Coulomb phase, it has to have the same behavior. And so that is something I would like to check. And I think I'll end here.
Questions? I have a question, maybe it's just about terminology, but so in 5016, I wouldn't call this the semi-classical set of quantum gravity. It's maybe a linear semi-classical set of quantum gravity. Because of course you're not going to get out the full non-linear richness of general relativity functions.
I don't see why not.
Because you're aiming just at the Newtonian potential. I mean, you're
how the full theory needs to
get. How do you want to get from linear quantum gravity to full non-linear semi-classical?
But that's not what I'm trying to do. The calculation in linearized quantum gravity was just to show that in that framework, the criterion works. But the criterion is meant to be applied to full theory. And the full theory should know about
the criterion. The criterion is motivated from the linear theory.
Yes. Yeah.
So
although
is it clear that it will work for the non-linear?
I think, I would expect so, because, for instance, the Wilson loop can be applied to QCD.
Yeah, but you would expect that something like a classical potential comes up. I mean, the Newtonian potential is like just, it's linear, right? So it's like, so the Newtonian potential kind of approach breaks down exactly where the
Mm-hmm.
So
that's something you could argue with.
I mean, I'm not saying that people would be completely impossible in the crush, but it's not clear right from the beginning to me that it would work.
I agree that it's not clear, but then again, you know, this criterion is that it's not something that is divine, it's something you need to motivate, and this could be an objection, sure, but my personal belief is that it is going to work in the full theory.
Sorry, Eddie?
My personal belief is that it will work in the full theory, it will make you motivate.
There are two different signals of compliance in this week. One of which is having the area log for the second section defines the area.
Mm-hmm.
And another one is electric field flux optimization, that non-dealing electric flux is quantized and applied to a superconductor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you look like that, the second one is satisfying. In fact, working in these state spaces we work in, where most of them speak as normalizable states, that's a signal basically the superconductor phase, what we call the superconductor phase.
Mm-hmm.
And in QCD, they would argue from that to confinement.
Mm-hmm.
So how should we worry about that?
So I think you're making a statement about behavior of the total. Or?
Yes.
Yeah. Should we be worried about that? No. I mean, as I said, I want to check what happens with the total, of course, but the Wilson loop, Oh, you are talking about
it. I'm saying the non-dealing electric flux is quantized, that's basically built
right
to the kinematic of open space.
Yeah.
Okay. If the dynamics were generated by the QCD Hamiltonian, then one would be able to argue for old arguments to an expectation that they would be built to carry on a perimeter log.
Okay.
So what is different about the dynamics of general relativity and quantum general relativity? Or should we worry that having built one signal for confinement in the kinematics, we can be stuck in the confinement phase and we're never going to get a cooling model?
No, I don't think that happened. Because of the heuristic argument I started with, so I showed this calculation of that was, of course, continuing field theory, but I was, you know, I argued about in what setting you would expect the static potential to govern the physics of the problem. And so as I argued, this should also go through for gravity. And I would, you know, if it doesn't, then I think there's something very wrong with moving on to gravity. Thomas, have you got some questions?
Max, if we can write on a complete set of graph of solos, I mean, electric fluxes and magnetic fluxes. So, is it possible to show that the criterion is equivalent or stronger than another criterion, which is that
I don't quite see the relationship.
So it's not equal?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Well, it might be, but I don't see how. It could be, but I don't see how.
Because, I mean, after all, saving plastic should approximate sufficient number of observables in the view.
Yeah.
So if your criterion doesn't do that, then one has to add more conditions.
Okay. That's what you mean. In that sense, I would say, yes, the criterion is weaker. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is not the only thing to work in the set of elastic states. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. question, maybe I have one question. Can I find things like the Schwarzschild or something like that?
If you have a family of seven classical states, then I would expect that it would be rich enough to include something like something that speaks around Schwarzschild. But the criterion doesn't give you families of states. It's a test. If you already have a family.
Right. How would I see that tomorrow? Or do you need to? All I was in the beginning is, if at all, I get these things off, right? I have to put these maths in into the states that I use to calculate this in the problem, right?
Yes.
So can I just say, if someone gives me a state and says this is the state approximately in function, can I use your criterion to say,
no, the criterion pertains to families of seven classical states, not to individual states. Let me just find the slide again. Do you just want me to formulate the criteria once again? Okay. So the criterion is that if I have a proposed family of semi-classical states in a canonical Hilbert space, then there should at least be two states in this family, psi 1 and psi 2, such that this one is peaked, and by peaked I mean, to find out using geometrical observables, say. This one is peaked at the phase space point where you have a non-trivial connection and a flat trial. And in particular, this should be Gaussian around half of a rectangular loop. And rectangular means rectangular with respect to this flat trial. And something similar for this state. And once I have that, then the inner product of the states should behave as follows. This is suspensions L, should be in the bar. Plus, sorry. That's the criteria. I call this self-energy because of the way it emerges. For instance, in this quantum electrodynamics scattering amplitude calculation I did, if you were to look at the details of that, you would see that it really is a self-energy.
The dependence on what?
On the connection.
You think the path to this connection.
Yes.
So
No, it's not arbitrary. It has to be Gaussian peaked around this, around half of the MD. So that means to apply the criterion, that simply means to apply the criterion, I have to pick very particular states. Certainly.
So
this family is going to be
contained.
A is just something that's Gaussian peaked around.
And then this zero is
Well, it falls off. It had a fall off. It does not have to be zero, I would say.
But why do you take
Okay, so the way this comes about, so I take your question to mean why does this overlap when you're saying giving you the rules of it. That's easy to see in for instance electromagnetism. So let's see. So the Wilson loop is this exponential I e over h bar, and then the vector potential, some form factor, and that's it. And so what is the explicit expression for, say, this state? Well, let's say the form factor associated with this half of the rectangle is F1k. Then the state psi 1 is, if you pick a normalized coherent state, it's precisely the following, 1 half I e over h bar d3x a hat. A, and then form factor, acting on the Fock vacuum, and the same for the other state, but with the other form factor, and I think you probably already start seeing how it comes about.
Almost.
What do you mean?
I thought that you were doing overlap between
two coherent states. There's
no overlap between two coherent
states. No, because A is not coherent states, it's C times A diagonal acting on the problem. Oh, so you object to the fact that I also include the annihilation operators. Oh, okay, yeah, but that's a question of terminology in my mind, because it's still true that the expectation value of the vector potential is still going to be zero in one of these states, and expectation value of the electric field is going to be proportional to this form factor. And to me, that's enough to call it a coherent state. It has minimum uncertainties. I don't see anything wrong with the very important
entry.
Well,
it's not one of the rules, okay?
No, that's true.
More questions?
No? Let's thank Chris again.
So I'm going to be here until Saturday, so if you want to discuss stuff, I'll be around.